Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, U.S. politicians and media talk about immigration all the time. But unless Thomas Friedman meets a chatty cab driver, we don't very often hear from immigrants themselves, and rarely at any length or with much substance. That's a problem in its own right, of course, but that invisibility also makes it much easier to demonize immigrants, particularly the undocumented, and to tell stories about the role of immigration in U.S. history that simply aren't true. This set of issues was forced into the daylight at the Boston Globe recently when a labor disruption by the paper's deliverers – yes, lots of people still get the physical newspaper – broached the dividing wall between reporters and the people whose difficult and undercompensated labor brings those reporters' work to much of the public. The story was recounted by Professor Aviva Chomsky. She teaches history and is coordinator of Latin American Studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Chomsky is author of the books Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, and They Take Our Jobs, and 20 Other Myths About Immigration. Her article, All the News That's Fit to Print, How Media Hide Undocumented Workers, appeared on TomDispatch.com. That conversation with Aviva Chomsky is coming up, but first, we'll take a look back at recent press. Whatever you think of the Bernie Sanders candidacy, it's driven elite media to some serious pearl-clutching that serves to illuminate the core values those media represent every day, election or no election. So we have David Brooks, the voice of sensible republicanism at the New York Times and on the PBS NewsHour and NPR, declaring in his February 9th Times piece that he misses the traits of character and leadership possessed by Barack Obama. Brooks doesn't like Trump's or Cruz's hatefulness, but what bugs him about Sanders is that he's, quote, so blinded by his values that the reality of the situation does not seem to penetrate his mind, close quote. That's unlike Obama, who promotes his values, quote, as much as he can within the limits of the situation, close quote. Pundits like David Brooks rarely take time to excavate who gets to determine the limits of the situation and whether or not that right is justifiably obtained. Instead, we're encouraged to embrace the status quo, which Brooks says, if we were only honest, we would acknowledge is pretty darn good. Sanders, Trump, Carson, and Cruz alike, Brooks writes, wallow in the pornography of pessimism. They'd have you think the country's on the verge of complete collapse, when in reality, quote, we have problems, but they are less serious than those faced by just about any other nation on earth, close quote. And that's the real tell. Brooks looks at a country with the most pronounced income inequality among wealthy nations, the largest trade deficit in the world, the highest gun-related murder rate in the developed world, a place where 1,000 people were killed by police last year compared to one in England and Wales, an infant mortality rate higher than Slovakia or Guam, not to mention Japan and Iceland, life expectancy worse than Lebanon or Greece, and moving in the wrong direction for one sector, middle-aged white people, largely due to increases in suicide, opiate overdoses, and cirrhosis. And Brooks sees a place where people with complaints should recognize that those complaints aren't serious. Well, you could note that that's less than surprising for a journalist who wrote recently about a luxury world tour he took and how it was hard to decide whether to have a second bottle of free champagne. But we should also be mindful of letting people that blinkered serve as arbiters for the merits of resigning oneself to the limits of the situation. Last week, Counterspin talked about conflicts of interest in coverage of the food industry. We were talking then about academics who take money from agribusiness being quoted by media without that disclosure. But sometimes it's the reporters themselves that raise concerns. Tamar Haspel is a food columnist at the Washington Post, but as Stacey Malkin writes for Fair.org, she also does a fair amount of paid speaking gigs for industry interest groups, including those promoting genetically engineered foods. That financial relationship is not always disclosed to readers, and its acknowledgement might help them process work like the column Haspel wrote in late January, in which she said that the surprising truth about the food movement is that there really isn't much of one at all. Most people, she says, don't really care about labeling GMOs. Her proof is that while polls routinely show that if you ask people if they want GMOs labeled, upwards of 90% say yes. But if you just ask them what they would like to see identified on labels, only 7% volunteer GMOs, at which point you are presumably meant to say, aha. Well, one of the surveys Haspel cites to support this comes from the International Food Information Council. That's a group supported by the food, beverage, and agriculture industries, though she doesn't spell that out. They rely on a survey designed by a professor from North Carolina State, Thomas Hoban, who himself is not totally keen on how his work is being used. Since the majority of people just don't know very much about GMOs, Hoban says, the findings don't so much say that they don't care about them as that the government needs to do a better job educating people about what's in their food. One might add that journalists could help with that education effort rather than pretending that the lack of awareness equals wholehearted acceptance. Finally, Americans are divided in many ways, but there are some points of convergence, one of which seems to be hatred of the cable company Comcast. Notoriously terrible customer service, a pricing system described as absurd, a stranglehold on internet speeds, all of that garners the cable company a remarkable amount of dislike and distrust. And that played a role in quashing its effort last year to merge with perennial runner-up for worst company in America, Time Warner Cable. You would think, therefore, that it would be bigger news that Americans who hate Comcast, largely for reasons related to its bigness, are now facing the possibility of essentially another Comcast. The harms from a possible merger between Charter Communications, Time Warner, and Bright House Networks were detailed in a piece for BillMoyers.com by Michael Copps. He's not a stranger to the issue, but the former chair of the FCC, and Copps says that this new mega company would control about a third of the nation's cable and cable broadband markets, would also own programming, including regional sports networks, and would dominate some of the biggest media markets like New York and Los Angeles. Worse, since the new company wouldn't compete in any markets with Comcast, they'd have no incentive to compete, but every incentive to coordinate against shared competitors, including those offering independent and diverse voices. Least surprising, the deal would start the new company off with some $27 billion in debt, a time-honored incentive to raise prices and cut services. And why not? Because where else will people go? Where there's still time to speak out against this Charter merger, one place you can file comments with the FCC is nomoremergers.com. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The Boston Globe's decision to contract out its subscriber delivery service to a new company that said they could do it cheaper was the kind of business call made every day. And media usually treat such events as just that, business news for the business page. But those decisions have human impacts, too, sometimes huge ones. It's just that the lives they change, generally speaking, aren't the ones that make the paper. Something different happened at the Globe, though, at least for a little while. Our next guest tells the story in an article for Tom Dispatch called All the News That's Fit to Print. Aviva Chomsky is professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. She's author of the book Undocumented, How Immigration Became Illegal, and also They Take Our Jobs and 20 Other Myths About Immigration. She joins us now by phone from Massachusetts. Welcome to Counterspin, Aviva Chomsky.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, the story you tell in the article is emblematic of a number of things. So let's just start in. The Boston Globe changes their delivery contractor, and what happens?
In a way, not to be too historical, but I think we have to start before they change delivery carriers with how newspapers are delivered at all in today's United States, mm-hmm. because I think a lot of people still have in mind that newspapers are delivered by 12-year-olds on their bicycles, and that's not how it is at all anymore. Newspaper delivery has become big business, and it's done through an elaborate system of subcontracting. And the people who deliver the newspapers are adults. They do it by car, and their routes are far longer and more complex than what the kids in the neighborhoods used to do. So newspaper delivery is a job that's done through subcontracting. It's a 365-day-a-year job. It has to be done in the middle of the night from about 2 a.m. until 6 a.m., no matter what the weather, what the conditions. And it's a job that's extremely poorly paid. That is, you have to have your own car, your own insurance. You have to drive hundreds of miles a week. But you're not considered an employee. You're considered an independent contractor. And therefore, the employer, which is the subcontractor, who is contracted by the newspaper, doesn't have any of the responsibilities that an employer has. They don't have to pay you minimum wage. They don't have to give you unemployment insurance, workers' compensation, Social Security. They get out of all their responsibilities as an employer.
Right.
And not surprisingly, this is an area of the economy where a lot of the people who work there are immigrants and a significant number are also undocumented, because it's designed to be a sort of a hidden underground piece of the economy. So that's how it's been. But then the Boston Globe decided they wanted to make it even cheaper for themselves, and they contracted out to a new delivery company that promised to give them a lower rate. And basically the only way to get a lower rate is to pay your workers even less.
What we would call cutting labor costs in the mainstream media, which
means paying
workers less who are already relatively very low paid or underpaid.
And there is something just a little bit ironic about this whole situation, that this is the newspaper, this is the people who are supposed to be doing the investigation and bringing the news, and that they're relying on this very hidden system of distribution.
It's actually kind of core to the story. I actually wanted to point out earlier for those folks who think, well, but nobody gets a print paper anyway, that 56% of Americans still read the newspaper in the hard copy. So let's move away from the idea that everybody's just reading it online. And then, yes, this is a business that you think is about transparency and about uncovering, and yet a core part of the industry itself is largely unseen. Well, the story that you write is actually about the broaching of that division, because what happens is that when the contract changes, workers are laid off. The new workers are not just getting paid less, but facing worse conditions. And there's actually a disruption in delivery. Is that right?
A huge disruption in delivery. So that tens of thousands of the Boston Globe's couple of hundred thousand subscribers are not getting the Globe day after day after day, week after week. It was a full month of delivery disruption. And this is really the first time that the newspaper itself and the newspaper reporters acknowledged that they had no idea how the paper ever got to its subscribers.
Well, that's what's fascinating, that the Globe now, for whatever reasons, they have the idea to have the reporters and other staff deliver the Sunday paper. And this is an event the New York Times and NPR do kind of fish out of water stories about reporters delivering the paper. My mother-in-law, Kathleen Narikas, who worked in journalism for many years, has a saying, partly humorous, that news is what happens to or near an editor. You know, and here we have a story. It's under the nose of reporters. But as you found, for the most part, and at least initially, the way they approached this story once they were kind of confronted with it and needed to report on it, the way they reported on it was kind of more of a reflection on them than on their ostensible subjects.
Yeah. And here, it's not just the Boston Globe reporters, but this story was picked up nationally. So it was in the New York Times. That is, the fact that Boston Globe reporters spent one night doing what immigrant workers do 365 days a year, that suddenly made national news. So NPR, as you said, the New York Times, Columbia Journalism Review, it was popping up everywhere, this amazing fact that newspaper reporters spent a night delivering the paper. And I'm surprised that no one was sort of embarrassed to acknowledge just how big this divide is and how unlikely and shocking it was that something like this could happen, that newspaper reporters could actually see how the paper gets delivered.
And what its implication is, of course, for the way that lack of experience impacts their reporting. I mean, part of what you found was reporters saying, wow, this is very eye-opening, you know, mm-hmm. the conditions that they're working in. That's dispiriting in its own way. But what you also found was a kind of, despite the confrontation with the reality and the difficulty of the job, there still was a kind of lack of interest, really, of digging into what that life was like.
Well, there were a couple of Globe reporters who really did try to get under the surface. And I have to especially give a shout out to Marcela Garcia, who's one of the few Globe reporters who actually speaks Spanish, which helped a lot, who actually interviewed some of the workers there. But most of the Boston Globe's reporting and the national level reporting ignored the workers completely. That is, it told the story about how the Boston Globe workers went out, but the emphasis was that the whole problem was software. That is, that the new company had inadequate software. So it tried to go sort of from one extreme of the reality of the grittiness and the exploitation involved in this actual physical labor and turn it into something technological and computerized and further invisibilizing the workers who actually do the work. So article after article said the problem was the software. The problem was the software.
Yeah, it's a technological fix to the difficulties. It wasn't even as if, I mean, it's an interesting thing that happened. First of all, I want to underscore, you cite one article that says, you know, whatever they're paying these people, it's not enough. Now that I've done this job, I see that it's very hard. And that idea of, well, whatever they're paying them, the fact that a reporter writing on this crisis labor situation would not have looked into it enough to see, what are they paying them? You know, what are the actual facts at hand here? What is the pay rate that these workers are objecting to?
And some of the reporting went even further. That is, they asked the Boston Globe and they asked ACI, the new carrier, and PCF, the old carrier, what they were paying. And none of those official sources were willing to tell them. But nobody asked a worker. Like, it's so easy to find out what they're paying. But they just went to the official sources and then they wrote that none of the official sources would tell them.
Well, so that's a big piece of this story, is that disconnect between the reporters, some of whom, of course, are writing about labor, some of whom are writing about immigration and immigrant communities not having this basic knowledge. But then what you wind up with about how, after some good reporting, the Globe itself seemed to come away with a kind of tech fix. What we needed was more sensible paper routes. This gets to a bigger point that you make about how we manage to disassociate, or maybe don't just manage, but work hard to disassociate our shiny, clean, virtual lives from the material world conditions and relationships that make them possible. And I take it that you see that attitude as reflected in not just media coverage, but also in policy, that we rely on these immigrant workers, but we don't acknowledge them.
And that's something that's almost built into our DNA as a country. And, you know, I teach history, so I'm always really shocked to see the extent to which students still in 2016 are coming into the classroom with these sort of sanitized, racially whitened versions of American history, where inequality, exploitation, people of color, extermination of Native Americans, taking of lands are just whitewashed out.
Well, let me just pull you into that. Election season, of course, is high tide for empty rhetoric. And one of the lines that we will hear and have heard is, America is a nation of immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard you speak about this before. When you hear that, oh, we're a nation of immigrants, what should we be bearing in mind when we hear that evoked?
Oh, well, thank you for asking me that question, because it's a phrase that we're hearing every single day now, and it just makes my skin crawl, because When we use that kind of language, we're a nation of immigrants, we're adopting what I would call a white supremacist version of U.S. history. That is, there's a hidden word in that, which is we are a nation of white immigrants. And the reason I say that word is hidden there is that for most of U.S. history, to be an immigrant, you had to be white. That is, only white people were allowed to be immigrants, that is, people who could become citizens. People of color who either were forcibly transported to the territory or who already lived in the territory were not considered immigrants. They were not eligible to citizenship. So when we talk about Ellis Island and welcoming immigrants, we're talking about white immigrants because only white people were allowed to immigrate during so much of U.S. history.
Well, a lack of historicity is a chronic problem with media. I mean, it's a way that coverage can work against understanding, even without being false, you know, at the level of the sentence. And continuing that historical theme, I wonder if you can talk about the historical creation of illegality. You know, because this is something that we hear all the time, that people don't oppose immigrants or immigration per se. It's the illegality of it. And I think there's a sense that that is a platonic understanding when, in fact, it's a historical creation.
And it goes back to what I was just talking about. That is, if only white people could be considered immigrants, people of color were welcomed into the country, but not as immigrants. That is, people from Africa were forced to come to the country, but not as immigrants. They weren't considered immigrants. And until really the 1960s, Mexicans were welcomed into the country also not as immigrants, but as workers and as specifically deportable workers because they could not be citizens, not being white. They were never considered immigrants, and there were a series of different legal regimes from the early 20th century through 1965 that over and over again reiterated the fact that Mexicans were absolutely necessary as a labor force, but they had to be deported when their labor was not needed, and that they would not be considered immigrants or potential citizens. And it's really in the civil rights climate of the 1960s that the deportability of Mexicans solely because of their racial slash national categorization of Mexicans started to become problematic. And the legal systems for deporting people just for being Mexican started to be dismantled. So that in 1965, when there's an immigration quota put on Mexico for the first time, that's acknowledging Mexicans as immigrants for the first time, but turning most of the Mexicans who are still being brought here as workers into illegal workers. It's a new way of enforcing deportability on Mexicans after it becomes unpolitically correct to say, well, of course they're deportable because they're Mexican. Now it becomes they're deportable because they're illegal.
Well, and that seems so crucial and so often papered over, this idea of status, in this case immigration status, as being caste, because it allows people to say we're not discriminating, you know, because it's not about race, it's just about criminality. And I understand that you see a connection between that status as caste and the legal disabilities that come along with it. That has other analogs in American society right now that are relevant.
Absolutely. And a lot of my thinking on this was really shaped by reading Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow, and looking at how new legal regimes enforce the same kinds of status under new language on African Americans.
Right. So you have African Americans disproportionately impacted by the criminal justice system who, once you have a criminal record, you can't vote, you can't serve on a jury, there are other things, benefits of citizenship that don't accrue to you, but it becomes difficult or more difficult somehow or ostensibly to trace it to race because it's not about race, it's about criminal status.
Although they're the very same rights that African Americans were deprived of on the basis of race until the 1960s.
Right. Well, again, it brings us back to the way that we talk about these things and what and who is missing from that conversation. So to just kind of bring it back around to the Boston Globe story, what we had there was a moment to include immigrant workers in the conversation about their own lives. Would you say it was a missed opportunity? I mean, what do you ultimately take away from that story that you wrote about?
Well, in terms of the news coverage, I would say there were a couple of Boston Globe reporters who tried really valiantly to highlight the labor issue, to make that be the focus of the discussion. Mm-hmm. But I would say the newspaper as a whole, the management of the newspaper, and the national level coverage just absolutely refused to acknowledge that.
And with that, I mean, a lot of what you're talking about is making invisible, you know, we're not talking about issues, we're talking about human beings. And a lot relies on not seeing the lives and the experiences of these people whose labor, in fact, impacts virtually every aspect of our lives. So it actually is kind of an effort to make us not see them in a way.
And I would really say that this is just one tiny example of how our immigration system, our foreign policy, our global economic system allows privileged people in the first world to enjoy the benefits of exploited third world labor without ever having to see it. And that the privilege of getting to enjoy the material fruits of it is compounded by the privilege of not having to know it's happening.
And I can't help but add that helping us know things are happening that maybe we don't want to know about really should be part of journalists' core work, I would hope.
Mm-hmm.
We've been speaking with Aviva Chomsky. Her most recent book is Undocumented: How Immigration Became Illegal. Aviva Chomsky, thank you so much for speaking with us this week on Counterspin.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. FAIR also publishes a newsletter called Extra. For subscription information, you can go to fair.org. The website's also the place to hear previous episodes of Counterspin or to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.